request your attention once more.
I'd like to follow through with my heretical project, the validation of self, and think for a moment with you together, what are the perks of having a self? You know? What makes it attractive? Why would we be interested in a self in the first place, if it takes so much effort to maintain, if every little emotion can throw it out of sync, if it produces so much pain for us, if it seems so unreliable that we have to identify with our thoughts to create such a self? Why would we want to set to sea in a sieve? Yeah, what was this? This is the Jumblies. Yeah. Why would we want to set to sea in a leaky boat? In the leaky boat of self, why, if so much bailing is needed, would we want to have one of them? Well, I think that's a good question. Yeah. Let's put aside the major notion of self the Buddha had with his particular time and tradition, an ontological, metaphysical self, which I would expect not many of you to have. Why would we want to invest in acts of selfing? Now, that's the other issue. Why would we want to engage in what the Buddha calls upadana, grasping, attachment, identification, if it lets us down so much as it actually does? Why would we want to keep doing this? I think there's some reason for this. I think one reason is it makes us safe. It makes us feel safe. Yeah. It is almost a spell against uncertainty. That's where psychology has a lot to say. We're really bad at handling uncertainty. If one thing really puts us on edge, it's uncertainty. We can cope with really bad things, but being uncertain about things is highly demanding, is highly stress-inducing. We can't move on when we're uncertain. We can't act in confidence. We can't let go if we're uncertain, if somebody is dead, for example. There's part of us that does not want to grieve when we're not really certain that somebody has died. We are freaked by the notion of uncertainty. Much of our efforts in life are directed toward creating stability, safety, control, reliability. Yeah. If you look at much of our bhava tanhai, Buddhist psychology, yeah, much of our desire to become is geared to make us feel safe. And I think that is precisely one of the reasons why we engage in a notion of self. It may not last for a long time, but you know, half hour wise, we can tide us over. We know who we are. We identify with a role, a job, a function. We identify with a particular configuration in our experience, and that makes us feel safe. It, for a moment, staves off the wolves of uncertainty. It doesn't last very long, but it is at least for that moment giving us a feeling of comfort, a feeling of stability. We're handling for a moment a world in which we have a role, in which we have a function, in which we are in control, which allows us to be predictable, to inhabit a predictable world. I don't know how it is with you, but if my computer has a malfunction, I would like this malfunction to go away. And I would also like to know exactly what was wrong, yeah? What happened that led to this malfunction, leaving me in a position, at least letting me believe that the next time this happens, I know what to do. What I really hate is I have a problem, a malfunction, and then it magically disappears. leaving me no chance to believe that it has disappeared due to my expertise or due to my competence at problem solving, and secretly suspecting that it may occur any moment again, and I'd be as clueless as I have just been 5 minutes ago before it had disappeared. Yeah. Maybe this is just a male preoccupation.
No.
I really hate problems to go away by their own accord and leaving me as helpless as I was before. You know, I like problems to rear their ugly faces, and then I kind of go into my gallant knight mode, and then I tackle the challenge and lower my visor and, you know, put in my javelin and do my gallant number. And then the problem, you know, is completely pulverized and powderized, and I stand there and basking in the glory of my success, and believing that henceforth, you know, more dragons and demons will come and will be meeting their fate through my glorious hands. That's what I like. Yeah. But that's not how life seems to happen. So I think we manage uncertainty by creating a self that is conveniently vaguely defined. You know, it's a little emotional, but it's also a little bit willful. It's also a little bit body, but it's also a little bit cognitive. It has to do with my dexterity in negotiating things, but at the same time, it gives me a consistent feeling of being me all the time. This is very neat. You know? It's a very neat psychological trick. My psyche gives me a very neat little tool there. Any conscious inquiry into the foundation of such a self will make its fallacious nature very quickly obvious. Western philosophers have done that. Yeah. Speech of Berkeley, to start with, has had a lot to say on this. Yeah. You know, many philosophers have suspected this, because any sustained self-inquiry will prove to us very quickly that the foundations for such a self are rather dubious. You know. They don't really turn out to be as reliable as we would like ourselves to be. And an apparently reliable self that is hinges on spurious foundations is not a very reliable self. But for our psychological comfort, if we skip the philosophical investigation bit, then that self-feeling, that meanness, the conviction, the solidity, the vitalization that comes from that seems to be good enough. So we keep shifting that self. I hope your self has moved on from a six-year-old self, you know. Occasionally, with occasional relapses, you know, I can relapse and suddenly something in here feels like a defiant six-year-old. Ever been there? Yeah? Something that goes into sort of, or even beyond 6 year old, you know, a little more primate, kind of drumming your chest, posing in silverback mode. Yeah. Sometimes we relapse in this, but most of the time we sort of muddle through, isn't it? It's a système débrouille, système de débrouillement. Yeah, we muddle somehow through. And we're not actually very interested in definition or in great accuracy of how we arrive at that sense. What is needed and what allows us to act in reasonably coherent and confident ways without being too stressed out is just having a feeling there's enough self-solidity there. There's enough overlap there between how I think about myself and what my environment feeds back to me, and what I want and what I get. There is enough overlap there that it kind of tides me over. You know? In other words, beautiful psychological concept, you have a good enough self. You know? It's not a really absolute self, it's not very reliable self, but it's a kind of good enough self, you know, that allows you to manage the vagaries of life without too much stress, without too much cataclysm. And that seems harmless enough. The problem is, there's no good ending for such a self. Anything that that self can depend on is likely to let it down, to let us down sooner or later. And the more successful you've tidied yourself over with such a self-construct, the more disturbing will be the experience that this is not reliable, that it sinks. It sinks despite your heroic bailing. So, that self needs a lot of support. Obviously, one reason why we put up with the effort is to create the protection. Even that protection ultimately turns out to be fallacious. It is one of the incentives. Another of the incentives is we find out that the concept of duration wards off the notions of change. If we invest in something that is called self, that gives me the feeling of continuity in my life. You know, that's me with Aunt Emmy there when I was 3 years old. There's nothing similar to that guy in the pram, you know, with Aunt Emmy. Some bald-headed, pot-bellied old guy pointing out to a three-year-old in a pram saying, "This is me in there with Aunt Emmy." It's a joke, isn't it? We all know it's a joke. There's nothing similar. The guy had none of the experiences I identify with. The guy had none of the skills I identify with. The guy had none of the problems I have. The guy has a lot more hair than I have. Yeah. It's a joke to identify this body here with that body on the picture. And yet we keep doing this, isn't it?
Yeah.
We keep doing this because we know that this being there somehow was a very early incarnation of this being now. We recognize that there is a continuity in our experience. The guy I put down on the pillow at the night has something to do with the guy I take up in the morning. They're not identical. He may have a nightmare in between, or an erotic dream, or he may have an illumination, or, you know, he may have slept wonderfully and feel restored while he was utterly knackered last night. All this is not really identical. But there is a continuity there. And self is one of the ways we label that continuity. We say, well, this is me. Even across 50 years, at the possibility of being made fun of when we say, yeah, to identify with a three-year-old in a pram. It yet it explains something of what we deep down sense is a process. The process is not A remains A, remains A, remains A. The process is something like A transforms into A1, A2, A3, and so forth, yeah? A1575 going on, and certainly that A doesn't resemble the A1 very much, but it has somehow begun with that A1, or it has become conscious. So we explain to ourselves continuity in a rather crude way by identification with the prior state or with the antecedent state. I think another reason why self is attractive, it gives us a protagonist for ownership. We're really into ownership. Now, ownership is a joke. If you look at it very closely, it's a complete joke. You cannot own a thing. You own nothing when you get born, and whatever you own, you will not take on when you die. This is very clear. We all know that. Many things in our lives we are owners of, and all civilizations have some concept of ownership. All our legal codes begin with ownership, if you bother to find out. You know. Hammurabi's codex will say something about ownership, and Justician law was something about ownership. Indian Vinaya honors ownership, the monastic discipline. Ownership is a real big concept in there. You would think, why would a bunch of alms mendicants who are not supposed to own things, why would ownership be such a concept in monastic discipline? It's a huge body of texts. A lot more interesting than the title suggests, by the way. But the Buddha is very clear. He says, you know, ownership has to be respected. Although you ultimately can't own things, you have to respect other people's property. And it's a clear breach of monastic law to take things that are not given, as we all know. Not just monastic law. It's a clear fundamental principle in the five precepts, for example, as understood to be a basis of harmony, is ownership, respecting ownership. But in an existential sense, you cannot own anything. Even if you eat it, it doesn't belong to you. It belongs to a process of nature, as mentioned this morning. We cannot take away the property when we die. Even when we travel abroad, when we chase the wave, when we have to flee, we cannot take things we own that rightfully belong to us, that we have worked for. These are conventions, but there is no guarantee that they stay with us. You have no right to believe that just because you've acquired something rightfully, that it's going to stay with you. It's quite weird to think that we actually own something, that we have a fundamental entitlement to property or possession, let alone ideas, you know, or skills, or functional competence. None of this is, we all know that this is really tremendously not true. Yeah. We all have lost things that we believe to have owned. We all have, you know, things have, maybe you may not lose it, the thing may just lose its value. Yeah. All these fabulous pieces of machinery that have just gone obsolete, that is waiting in your garage, you know. I remember my record collection that I carefully accumulated before becoming a monk, finally. I wanted to give my brother my jazz collection, and he didn't want it, and I threatened to just drive to the garbage dump and have it all burned in there. And then he finally relented. he took my jazz collection. Some of it. Just because he didn't want me to burn what I had spent so many years collecting. No, I don't think I've converted him to listening to jazz. So I guess finding ownership, making acquisitions and making things mine are things that act in this world to something that procures me again duration, safety, control, reliability, isn't it? That's such a huge motor. Now, why do you think this is such a huge motor? It's again the uncertainty stuff. We really handle that change badly because we all know deep down that change implies mortality. Change implies I change too. This world is going to disappear under my senses. We all know that. So, I have a few protective strategies. I amass stuff, which gives me a feeling that I will never go hungry. I have power. I have comfort. I can create safety for myself and for others. I create a self, which allows me to create continuity, which allows me to have a meaningful narrative in my life by saying, this is what I did then, and then I learned that, and then I did this, and then I went there, and then I found out that. Yeah. Right, I have something in the face of change. Safety comes from stuff. Duration comes from narrative and continuity. And that means I don't die. If I have a story, I don't die. Because story are the things that don't die in our world. If you don't want to die, join a story. You know? Create a story. Leave a story behind. Now, these are very powerful tools in which we have found out in the face of change to leave our mark, to leave an imprint. Then there are other things. There's a convenience in having a knowledge of what I like and what I don't like. And if I have a knowledge, a body of knowledge of my likes and what I don't like, then I have a better chance of actually maximizing my likes and minimizing my dislikes. So I become an expert in Akinjana's likes and dislikes. I become an expert in this body's likes and dislikes. I know something which Thai foods, this digestive system is comfortable digesting and which not. I become an expert in Akinjana's likes and dislikes. I become my own expert. How this system can be managed, maximizing things it prefers and minimizing things it finds insulting. So a self is a neat administrator of my likes and dislikes. Then I believe one of the reasons why we end up with the self is language, at least the way most of our Western languages operate, is suggestive of a personal pronoun that is doing much of the work, that is receiving the world, that is agent in this world, that is corroborated through being addressed to as an interlocutor. And I think, although this is a conventional reality, it begins to sink in after a while. Because you tell me my name, I actually begin to believe I am existing. I begin to believe that there is such a thing as a Akinjana. If I can convince you to feed back an Akinjana I like, to boot, that's really good news for me. Then I don't have to do much of myself in work my own. I can leave that to you. And you, conveniently feed back a highly pleasant self-object to me that I can happily internalize and move on with. To speak in psychological language. So I think there are a few perks on having a self. It protects, it explains a story, it provides continuity, it offers duration, and it manages likes and dislikes, and it reifies what language does. Those would be a few reasons why we arrive at the self. But it doesn't work in the long run, as it keeps letting us down. It doesn't stop us from enthusiastically shifting our objects of identification, what Buddhist psychology so neatly identifies as grasping, identification, attachment. We just get better at attaching quickly at something new. My dog dies, I get a new dog. My car is getting too expensive, I get a smaller car. I'm unhappy with the place I live. I get a new place. The new place is called my home. And it has my name at the post box. We all do this in countless ways. So I think the reification is an interesting one. It's not just language. Buddhist teaching says also a few things about that perception has a role to play in this. Reification happens through perception. You have a sensory reality which moves continually. It's never solid, never still. Continual sensory impingements. Every moment of my life, so many things happen. In my eyes, in my ears, in my head, in my nose, in my tongue. So many sensory data flowing into this being, getting processed. And I perceive them, I chunk them together. I never get what my eyes are actually doing when I look into your face. I get a very abbreviated version of this. When we study sensory movements, we know that my eye is actually scanning your face in very rapid movements around your eyes, around your nose, around your mouth. That's what my eyes are doing when I recognize your face. But I don't get this movement. All I get is, oh, this is Peter, or this is Susie, or this is Pedro. I don't actually get what my senses are doing. I get something of a recognition, a serialized, chunked version of my sensory impingement, which is conveniently abbreviated to a name. And then that name, it identify with your face. If it's looking reasonably similar to your face, it must be you. So I now have a reasonably solid concept called Peter for a complicated sensory maneuver called seeing. And Peter now, I can name, I can remember, I can attribute qualities to Peter, smart guy, a pest, you know, makes my life joy. Peter is my love, Peter is my bane, yeah, whatever. And whenever I see enough Peter-like phenomena in my life, I pull up that story. Peter is my joy, Peter is my bane, Peter is a pest, Peter is my love, yeah. And I conveniently neglect the fact that Peter has grown a few gray hair in the meantime, Peter has undergone big changes in his life, Peter is no longer who he used to be for me. I conveniently cut all this out. I identify him with my concept I have arrived at from him. If I'm compassionate, I'm willing to update my concept of Peter. If we love people, we update our concepts more often. If we don't love them, we update them never. That's why it's so difficult to say of somebody whom we love how this person really is. Yeah? Because we know this person so well. We see this person in so many different facets and changes that we find it difficult to label this person with one quality or one adjective or even five. But somebody whom we don't like, we find it not difficult at all. Since we never update our perception, we find it quite easy to say, you know, he's a real, you know, dot, dot, dot. Yeah? And when 6 months later somebody asks us about him, we say exactly the same thing, you know. Is that real, you know? And when you go back, actually, what that hinges on, then it's a memory that is 15 years old, you know, that happened under particular circumstances. And we keep reheating this memory whenever the topic comes onto Peter. And since we have never anything to do with him, and since we never bother to update our perception, we keep heating up that old perception of him. Which doesn't do justice what happened to the guy or how he is today. So I think some of the reification happens through unconfirmed perceptions, through old perceptions. Perception is a magic moment when immediate, fresh experience is met with an orienting, a labeling, and a conceptualizing take in our mind, referring to memory and experience, previous experience. In other words, there's something new happening, and it is being labeled, understood, and categorized in terms of that which we already know. In other words, we use some old stuff to pigeonhole something that is happening just now. So perception is always a mix of things. Something immediate, generally sensorially based, that is serialized, chunked, and interpreted in terms of that which we already know. In other words, in terms of something that is not new, that is based on experience, and the distortion that has happened in our experience, and the lack of information that has happened in our experience. So, and as soon as we identify Peter with our perception of Peter, the guy has no chance, you know. We make him part of our story. We appropriate him in some way. And we keep relating to our version of Peter rather than to people. So we keep relating to our concept of him. And that suddenly, that's convenient because we then, we own it. We know about him. We recognize it. We attribute intention and motive. If it's bad, we attribute purpose to his life. He's the one who makes my life miserable. He's the one who is always to blame that I'm not happy. He's the one who, who is my joy. We attribute functions, roles, intention to this concept. That has a lot more to do with us than with Peter. So I keep living in a world that is reified perception of a Kinjino, but I actually believe it's a world out there. But in fact, it's just part of a Kinjino story. A Kinjino has just appropriated this world into his story. And the world has more and more to do with my story and less to do with what's actually happening. So that's, I think, one of the processes that self really feeds off. Me as the great interpreter of a world that then turns into my story. So perception is something Buddhist psychology says we have to have a close eye on. We can't live without perception meaningfully. At the same time, these perceptions are not what they pretend to be. They are not clean representations of the world. They are our version of the world. And that version has a lot more to do with our needs, our fears, our desires, our confusions, than with what they pretend to be. Yeah? Namely, objective representations of something actually taking place. So Buddhist psychology suggests we keep investigating perceptions and scrutinize perceptions for distortions that take place there. There's a huge topic of Buddhist psychology geared to scrutinize forms of perception and falsifications that take place there. And then finally, lastly, I think one of the things that helps at the reification of the self is our attentional focus. Our movements of attention. Our movements of attention are preoccupied with objects. We have an object bias. When we come into a room, we don't see the room. We see the people, the things in the room. Whenever there is something that we can chunk, we like to do our attention to do the chunking rather than to hold the space. We gravitate quite powerfully. If you say to things, there is a reification bias in our mind. If you sit down and you have a few thoughts in a very spacious mind, I bet your attention will go to the thoughts. It will not see the space. It will see the thoughts. It will focus on the thoughts. It will think the thought is the event here that rightfully gets my attention. So we keep losing relations, we keep losing space, we keep losing context in favor of the thinginess of our lives. Yeah? It's quite easy to see. When there is nothing, we're quite ill at ease. When there is no sound, when there is no body, when there is no apparent thing, you know, we're quite bewildered. We feel slightly betrayed. You know, I've come here for something. I've come here for somebody. I've come here for some event. And it's not happening. We're quite uneasy with ourselves, without the thing, without the object, without the person, without the reifiable piece of world. So our attentional patterns are quite strongly gravitating to identify little chunks of experience and then building a world, building a story out of this. Our meditation teachings have always done the opposite. They've suggested to you, stop identifying with your thoughts. Look at an aspect of your thoughts, namely that they cease, for example. That's much more powerful. Just all sorts cease. Clever thoughts, big thoughts, small thoughts, trivial thoughts, profound thought, every of them has ceased. Yeah? Let's establish a universal characteristic of thought, namely arising and ceasing. But that's very difficult to do, isn't it, meditators? We're so entrenched in our dabbling with the story of the thought that it's the content that preoccupies us. And so that's why much of contemplative teachings keep shifting from object and content and event to process. Keep shifting back to big picture. Okay, very interesting thought, but right now, what interests us in this thought is, has it ever been there? No, it has arisen. Does it change while it's there? Yes, it's actually moving. Does it go somewhere? Yes, it's actually stopping, tapering off, disappearing, going on the pile of many dead thoughts behind the curtain. Yeah, we can establish this as universal features of thought. But instead of that, we get fascinated with the content, with the specificity of thought. Does that make sense? That
yes.
That attentional bias is one of the things that helps us arrive at the reified notion of both world and ourselves. And contemplative traditions have always tried to shift emphasis back there. Huh. Good. Let me end here. Please take whatever you can. Stop trying to become Buddhists or stop trying to become anatta believers. No amount of believing in impersonality will give you a taste of impersonality. Let us do what the Buddha suggested, namely squarely, when it feels like self, investigate that self feeling. Investigate what is it founded on? What is the apparent substratum of that self? Can I inquire into this? Can I verify its solidity, its unconditional nature, its true ownership, or my true ownership of this? These would be cheeky questions to ask, whenever it feels self. The whole of the teaching of the Buddhist section on the khandhas, the aspects of experience, has this sole purpose. The whole of this teaching, there's a huge chunk of Buddhist teaching on aggregates, on aspects of experience, as I like to call them. And fairly convoluted teaching. It's not a straightforward teaching for many of us because it takes a lot of conceptual undoing. This whole teaching is dedicated to one single thing, to provide a framework for investigation, the basis and foundation of anything that feels like selfhood. And we arrive, the power of this teaching is not in that we believe there is no self, or we proclaim there is no self, or we become sort of wave the flag of anatta. None of this is particularly helpful. What is helpful is that we feel the empowerment whenever it feels like self, that we are trying to question further and say, where does this feeling come from? What does it rest on? What is its foundation? And we inquire into the solidity, into the unconditional nature, and into the personal quality of that apparent foundation. And it's the repeated inquiry into this, and the repeated acknowledgement of your conclusions, that is what frees us from the fallacious affirmation in a self that hinges on conditions. Good, I hope I haven't killed you in the process.